Europe's been hit, Asia's been hit, Africa's been hit. This is what we will expect to be routine as climate changes.
Billions of people around the globe reeling under extreme heat. It's Friday, August 10th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also coming up, Nagasaki marks a somber anniversary. Once again, the trade war heats up between China and the U.S., and using drones to help feed the world. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A somber remembrance in Japan today. Traditional Japanese bells ringing in Nagasaki's Peace Park and all across the nation Thursday, marking the 73rd anniversary of the atomic bombing of that city toward the end of the Second World War. Thousands of dignitaries and survivors paused in silence at 11:02 a.m. local time. That's the exact moment in 1945 when the U.S. atomic weapon known as Fat Man exploded over the city. 74,000 people were killed in the bombing itself, and untold thousands more suffered injuries and a lifetime of illnesses caused by the bomb's radiation. The Nagasaki bombing was, and still is, only the second time an atomic weapon has been used offensively by one country against another, both times by the United States against Japan. The first came just a few days earlier, when the U.S. bomber Enola Gay dropped an atomic bomb over Hiroshima. That blast and resulting firestorm killed upward of 145,000 people. Among those on hand today was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who warned, quote, that fears of nuclear war are still with us decades after the Nagasaki bombing. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Thursday called for the complete elimination of nuclear weapons at a ceremony marking the 73rd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. It was the first time a UN Secretary General attended the Nagasaki Peace Memorial Ceremony held every year. His predecessor, Ban Ki-moon, was the first to attend the anniversary event commemorating the Hiroshima atomic bombing in 2010. During his speech, Guterres said fears of a nuclear war still exist today, and it remains the highest priority for the United Nations.
Let us commit to making Nagasaki the last place on Earth to suffer nuclear devastation. The total elimination of nuclear weapons remains the highest disarmament priority of the United Nations. Here in Nagasaki, I call on all countries to commit to nuclear disarmament and to start making visible progress as a matter of urgency. And nuclear weapon states have a special responsibility to lead.
The mayor of Nagasaki called on the Japanese government to join the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons Treaty in order to lead a nuclear-free world. Japan is the only country to suffer atomic bombings.
The core of the Dome of Nagasaki, target for atom bomb number 2, is filmed from a super fortress many miles away.
Tokyo did not take part in the UN negotiations on the treaty, saying such talks without nuclear-armed countries participating would not contribute to bringing about a world without nuclear weapons. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
These are among the top Asia stories on VOAnews.com. Five former dual nationals have been stripped of their Australian citizenship because of their involvement with the IS group. Police in Bangladesh fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse students who protested for a ninth day, demanding better enforcement of traffic safety laws. A second year of martial law in parts of the Philippines is squelching any comeback by violent Muslim insurgent groups. And Pakistan has wrapped up a contract with Russia that would, for the first time, allow Russian military training of Pakistani army officers. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more on VOAnews.com. VOA Asia continues. China's producer price index, a measurement of inflation, slowed slightly in July, rising 4.6% compared to June's 4.7. It's the first reading on the impact on prices from China's growing tariff battle with the United States. Beijing also announced another round of tariffs on U.S. imports beginning August 23rd, matching U.S. duties of $16 billion on Chinese goods coming into the U.S., which is seeking a change in Chinese trade and economic policies. Julian Evans Pritchard is an economist with Capital Economics in Singapore. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the last reading on inflation reflects a slowing Chinese economy.
I think it's a sign that basically the sharp pickup in producer price inflation that we've seen over the past couple of years, that's now easing in large part because the Chinese economy has started to slow again as the impact of previous stimulus has faded, which I think is why you're seeing that downward trend. You know, that is going to probably intensify over the next half year or so as the economy continues to cool.
At the same time, China's exports to the U.S. surged last month. What does that tell you?
I think if we look at the big picture, exports to the U.S. broadly stable, not much impact of the tariffs that came into force last month were evident in the latest data. You know, partly that's to be expected, given that the initial round of tariffs was only on $34 billion, which is quite a small portion of what China exports to the U.S., but also that there may have been some efforts to front-run those tariffs during the first week of the month, which may have supported exports there. So I guess we'll have to wait until we get the August data to get a clearer idea. But at this stage, the tariffs imposed so far are quite small, so I don't expect to see a big impact. And on top of that, you have a great deal of offset from the weaker RMB that's likely to come through over the next few months as well, which will help to lower China's export prices.
China has just announced it's going to impose a 25% tariff on $16 billion of import goods from the United States. Obviously, the tariff war continues.
Yeah, so we've known that this is coming for quite a while. When the U.S. announced that they would impose an initial $34 billion and then a subsequent $16 billion, the Chinese immediately said that they would retaliate in kind. So we're now at the stage where they're finalizing the date, which is the 23rd of August, and the lists involved. So it's not really a further escalation of the tariff threat. It's more of just working out the details. I think, you know, $16 billion is fairly insignificant. The real concern and what's uncertain at this stage is whether the Trump administration will push ahead with the additional $200 billion that's currently under review. And it's also not clear what tariff rate will be applied to that because they initially threatened a 10% rate, but there's now talk of a 25% rate. So that's, you know, the key factor, what happens to that additional $200 billion, because that's going to have a much bigger impact.
You expect that impact to result in a slowing Chinese economy?
Well, I think it will contribute to weaker exports to some degree. And there are also other headwinds to the Chinese economy domestically, particularly from the slowdown in credit growth that we've seen over the past year or so. And also, as a result, the continued controls on the property market, which don't seem to be likely to be lifted anytime in the immediate future. So you have multiple headwinds facing the economy. And the additional headwind of U.S. tariffs, it's not the biggest headwind, but it doesn't help either. And I think clearly the direction of the Chinese economy over the next 6 months or so, we're going to see weaker data, a further loss in momentum, and that's probably going to trigger an increased policy response, both in terms of monetary policy and fiscal policy being eased.
The state-run China Daily editorialized on Thursday, the bilateral trade spat is merely push and shove at the moment. But it warned it will likely escalate into more than just a scuffle if the U.S. administration cannot marshal its, quote, mobster mentality. It said while China is doing its utmost to avoid a trade war, it has no choice but to fight back. Happening now in Asia, Asian stocks closed mixed on Wednesday, with China losing steam after rebounding in the last session. Japan's Nikkei 225 closed marginally lower, while South Korea's Kospi index inched higher. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is appealing for $9 million to provide emergency aid to some 80,000 survivors of two devastating earthquakes that flattened large swaths of Indonesia's tourist island of Lombok. Officials say the death toll has reached more than 220, with hundreds of other people injured. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
The Red Cross describes the damage in North Lombok as exceptionally destructive, with 75% of the buildings in some villages damaged or turned into rubble. Red Cross Federation spokesman Matthew Cochran says some of the more remote areas of the island are cut off and have not yet been visited. He says it will take many days for the full impact of the disaster to emerge.
One of the interesting things coming in from our teams is the psychological toll of the earthquake. Teams speak of coming across ghost towns of villages that have been essentially abandoned. People have left their homes. They're fearful of living, of staying inside, or perhaps fearful of another major earthquake and a possible tsunami.
Cochran says these emotional scars and the concerns of the remote communities will have to be addressed in addition to providing survivors with emergency shelter and other basic relief. The Red Cross reports some of the thousands of families forced to flee their homes are staying in evacuation centers or in makeshift camps in open areas. The agency says its appeal will provide emergency shelter supplies, as well as materials for repairing and rebuilding damaged houses. Over the coming 18 months, the Red Cross says its emergency operation will focus on creating livelihood opportunities for the survivors. It also will provide health, water and sanitation, protection, and information on disaster risk reduction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo, your host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. From counting birds in the wild to discovering planets beyond our solar system, citizen scientists are non-professional, everyday people who have been playing an important role in furthering science research. I hope you'll join me on our next edition as we talk about citizen science. That's the Science Edition of Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A caterpillar native to the Americas that has devastated crops across Africa has now made its way to Asia. Indian scientists say they've identified the army worm on more than 70% of maize crops in Karnataka state. First time the army worm has been spotted in Asia. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. The war of words over a possible war of trade continued to escalate on Thursday. Grace Lee has the details.
Beijing sent another warning shot to Washington on Thursday, with its state media accusing the U.S. of mobster mentality. In an editorial, state newspaper China Daily said that China's still trying to avoid a trade war, but in the face of America's, quote, ever greater demand for protection money, it has no choice but to fight back. This comes after blowback on Wednesday, when China vowed to slap additional tariffs on U.S. imports, 25% on $16 billion in goods, in retaliation to U.S. plans of collecting the same. In July, both countries slapped duties on $34 billion of each other's imports, with Washington firing first. Now the U.S. says it's considering hiking proposed tariffs on additional $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. The trade dispute between the two are already impacting a range of industries, from steel to cars, and causing tensions over which products could be targeted next. China says it can weather the storm, and official data on Wednesday backed up that claim. It showed the country's exports rose more than expected, and import growth accelerated to its fastest since January.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Malaysia's parliament has repealed the goods and services tax. The unpopular consumption tax was abolished just over 3 years after its implementation. The government is replacing the GST with the sales and service tax that will be implemented next month. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. on VOA Asia, many parts of the world are experiencing record heat this summer. California is seeing earlier, longer, and more destructive wildfire seasons. While the deadliest wildfire in Greece's recorded history has killed more than 90 people just last month. Forest fires are burning in Europe's northern countries, such as Sweden and Latvia, and extreme heat has had its effect on agriculture and has been killing fish in a section of the Rhine River in Switzerland. All of this comes as new reports show the planet heating at a pace that could make some places uninhabitable in the coming decades. VOA's Lori London spoke about this with St. Thomas University in Minnesota climate scientist Dr. John Abraham.
Some of the things you didn't mention are how badly hit Arctic countries are. I mean, we had heat waves in Canada and in Scandinavia, and we've had 90 degrees near the Arctic Circle. Europe's been hit, Asia's been hit, Africa's been hit. This is what we will expect to be routine as climate changes. Humans have emitted heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere for years now, and scientists have told us what was going to happen, and we're seeing it. And we've not only seen it this year, but we've seen it in past years with the crazy hurricanes last year, the incredible drought and heat wave in California, in the Midwest in 2012. So this is an ongoing trend, but it's getting worse and worse every year.
There seems concern, but not a will to do anything about it. And of course, here in the U.S., we have an administration that doesn't want to acknowledge that climate change is real, but it seems like that conversation should be way past even something we're having.
Fortunately, other countries are taking the lead. And if there's any silver lining that we have here is the U.S. is losing its ability to throw monkey wrenches into the gears of progress. And other countries are realizing that they need to take action and become the leaders because the U.S. won't. The U.S. is the worst country in the world when it comes to climate change. We're the only country not to have signed on to the Paris Accord, which is an international agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have an administration who attacks scientists for reporting facts and reporting measurements. It is exactly true, as you've said, the U.S. is not taking action, but other countries are. And the beautiful thing is the solutions to climate change are also solutions to our energy problem. For example, wind and solar power are now so cheap, they can compete head-to-head with coal power. So we're in a situation where no one in their right mind would build a new coal power plant because you can generate electricity with wind and solar, save the environment, and save money. And that's a tipping point of a good kind. It's a tipping point of economics that's going to bring us into a new era.
But you're saying that things are getting worse. It doesn't appear that whatever humans are doing right now to fix the situation is enough to stop what we continue to see happening.
Well, that's exactly right, Lori. We can't stop what's happening, and we're not doing enough to stop it. But what we can do is slow it down. And what we can do is create a bad situation from a horrific situation. If we continue business as usual, this world is going to be an ugly place to live in a few decades. But if we take action now to reduce our emissions and to develop more clean, renewable energy, we can turn this into just a bad situation that we can handle. So humans have the power to make this a lot less worse than it would otherwise be. Now, I tell you this, time matters. And if we would have taken action 2, 3, 4 decades ago, we wouldn't be in the predicament that we are now. But the longer we delay, the harder it is going to be to get off the track to catastrophe. And that's why every year matters and every administration matters.
Been seeing a lot of articles lately that saying we're really close to the point of no return. You know, you have a positive attitude about what we can do to change this. And we've been hearing that for a long time. But it just really doesn't seem like progress is moving fast enough to keep up with getting to the point of no return. And how close are we to that?
Well, it depends on what you define point of no return. If the point of no return is we're going to see climate change that really affects human societies, we're past that. But there are other points of no return that we want to keep our eye on that are also important. And those are points of no return where what are called feedbacks kick in. Let me give you an example. The ocean right now is doing us a great service by gobbling up a lot of the greenhouse gases that we emit into the atmosphere. But the ocean's ability to do that decreases as it warms. And at some point, we're going to cross a tipping point where the ocean is not able to gobble up the greenhouse gases. That would be a point of no return for the ocean. That would be terrible. Another example is methane in the tundras in the Arctic. If we warm the Arctic too much, the ground will release its methane, which is a super strong greenhouse gas. So that would be another terrible point of no return. If we cross those, we're in a lot of trouble because then we lose control over the climate. But until we cross those tipping points, humans have our foot on the accelerator, and we can take our foot off anytime.
What do you think the likely outcome here is?
The likely outcome is it's going to get really bad, and people who are not able to afford adaptation will suffer the most, but everyone's going to suffer. Whether it's droughts or heat waves or whether it's floods, we have the infrastructure to handle it to some extent. But climate change is going to become so bad that even in the U.S., we're going to really struggle to deal with it. The future is going to be riddled with stories of very expensive costs to human society in both dollars and lives because we didn't take action.
Dr. John Abraham with Minnesota's St. Thomas University. Finally, unmanned aerial vehicles, commonly referred to as drones, may become an important tool for farmers around the world within the next decade. Researchers at Texas A&M University are looking at different applications of precision farming done with drone technology. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the details.
A drone may soon become an invaluable part of farming.
One of my chores for my parents is to go weed garden with a hoe. And so now I'm talking about, well, no, I'm not going to send a hoe out there. I'm going to fly out there with my drone and I'm going to take care of the weeds that way.
From weeds and pests to the overall health of the plant, researchers say drones are the future of precision agriculture.
You can know where to apply pesticides, fungicides, fertilizer in specific areas of the fields instead of doing the entire fields.
What it's really doing is giving us a new way to estimate yield and to figure out which plants are best. And our goal is really to breed better crops and to help farmers get better economic value from whatever they plant.
Different sensors can be placed on drones to give researchers different types of plant data from a bird's eye view.
We can look at spectral characteristics, so the greenness of the plant. I think everybody's seen where if you fertilize a plant, it greens up. It looks better.
Drones can also combat weeds.
A lot of the problems we run into these days are herbicide-resistant weeds, as well as weeds that typically escape control measures and become a problem in future years.
And one weed can produce millions of seeds. So that means that seed would be going into the soil, and that seed bank would raise more plants next year.
Conventionally, crop consultants would walk the fields looking for problematic weeds, insects, and disease, which is time-consuming, expensive, and not completely accurate.
If drones can be employed, it will save a lot of time. It will be a lot more effective and accurate.
Instead of spraying the entire field with chemicals against herbicide-resistant weeds, drones could be used.
If I knew all the bad spots in my field, I could do a bunch of drones and do a bunch of small drones to go and attack those areas with whatever chemical I want to have, what kind of pesticide or fungicide I need.
Probably in the next 5 or 10 years, you're going to see very easy to use software packages where a farmer or a researcher in Africa or Asia or South America can take these tools and basically get high quality data they can use for plant breeding or making decisions on when to spray their crop.
In the meantime, researchers say even at a basic level,
okay, video,
drones can allow anyone with a smartphone to record videos and take photographs to monitor farms, large and small. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, College Station, Texas.
And that is VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the week. We hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you again next week.